Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind after our short break. It's with me, Tris Dixon, John Rawling and Ian Dark, two of the voices of a generation of boxing. Gents, this week we are talking about heroes, sort of cult heroes, uncrowned champions, whatever it might be, maybe some of the less fashionable names that we've covered, guys who are really good fighters and maybe didn't quite get the props. And I've got a list of names here in front of me because I'm sure that you would have covered them all in different formats, one way or shape or form, whether it's radio or TV. And one of the guys at the top of my list is Steve Robinson, the Welshman, who obviously, I suppose, in history is a very, very good, significant British fighter who won a world title, but it's probably, sadly, best known for that night where Naz went and took the title from him in Wales. Ian, you obviously remember that night very well.
Yeah, I do. I mean, and I think everybody knew that what was going to happen that night because Naz was obviously a special talent. Steve had the crowd. My goodness, he had the crowd that night, that manic atmosphere. But I think it was always likely that Nassim Mohammed would have his number. And of course he did, even though the whole crowd were chanting fairly vile chants in favor of their man. But, you know, you talk about, you know, Andy Warhol's 15 minutes of fame. It was a bit more than 15 minutes, wasn't it, for Steve? He won the world title, as I recall, you know, standing in as a 48-hour substitute. And hopefully he made a bit of money. It really was almost the ultimate Cinderella story.
Yeah, he had that purple patch, didn't he, John? With I think Colin McMillan and Duke McKenzie, wasn't it? I think, and basically the stars aligned for Steve Robinson there for a period of time, but unfortunately, they took him to Naz. Yeah, or fortunately, is if the money's anything to go by, I guess.
Two very good wins they were, weren't they? And he was an immensely dedicated and fit sort of guy, and one of the nicest blokes you would come across as well. He wasn't maybe the most charismatic interviewee, but my goodness, he lived the life. You know, never let himself get out of shape. Always immensely well prepared. And I think the public, who probably didn't know very much of this lad from Cardiff before he became the world champion, they warmed to him because they recognised that here was somebody who was making the most of a very surprising opportunity that was brought to him, and not only making the most of it, but capitalising big time. And yeah, I think he did make a few quid. And when you look at him now, these years after, he's still instantly recognizable as the fighter who got in the ring. He's still in tremendous physical shape, and you speak to him and he still very much seems the same guy.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, he was from that tough area of Cardiff called Ely, wasn't he? Do you remember? You're quite right. I love stories like that as well, where journeyman fighters get a surprise chance and suddenly they become more mainstream. I mean, another one that springs to mind in that category in the time I covered boxing was Dennis Andres, you know, and what a guy he was. And he ended up in some pretty biggish fights in America. You know, he even fought Tommy the Hitman Hearns at the Cobo Hall in Detroit. I remember covering that. And we all went to Tucson, Arizona, when he won the world title. And I remember being in the bar afterwards, and you know, he lined us all up glasses of champagne while he drank orange juice and thanked us all personally for coming to covering his great night. But of course, he went home and all the talk was about Frank Bruno's heroic effort against Mike Tyson and not about Dennis's world title win. And, you know, he famously, and I think the story is well documented by now, but we'll tell it again, how he turned up at the press conference having got the tube train and with his world title belt in a carrier bag.
And yeah, he got the respect as well, Dennis, didn't he, of the really, really hard, brutally hard fighters who used to go in the Kronk gym. He went over there, and he was the limey turning up in America, and they were ready to intimidate him. And, you know, Dennis was just such a hard man. He'd have none of it. And he got so much respect from, I think, just about everybody in that gym, and particularly Manny Steward, for being prepared to get in there and work hard and work in a tremendously committed way with some of the toughest people in boxing.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about trilogies, we probably don't talk enough about Dennis Andreese and Jeff Harding, who had three terrific fights, didn't they? Ian, I'm sure, were you at least one of those, if not all of them?
I think it was a couple of them, maybe not all three. They were close, weren't they? Close fights, terrific fights. And, yeah, John's right. What Dennis did, dragging himself off to the Kronk and fighting in there, because yeah, I think everybody who follows boxing, or certainly boxing from that era, knows that there was no such thing as light sparring or anything like that at the Kronk. You went in there and it was a war. It was like a real fight every day. But the wear and tear on those fights, as you could question, but my goodness me, it toughened you up for what lay ahead. So, yeah, I mean, big spot for Dennis, you know, and I hope he earned more money than I suspect he did.
So, Ian, while we're on this, I mean, he doesn't do many interviews now at all, Dennis. And I've tried speaking to him in the past, not since I've had Boxing Life Stories, but I managed to get one line out of him for Emmanuel Stewart's obituary for Boxing Life Story for Boxing News, and that was it, one line, and he didn't want to say anything else. So we don't know, this era don't know about Dennis Andreese the person. What was he like to deal with as a professional prize fighter?
Not really that communicative, because I think he just was one of those guys, just like John said, he was a real hard man, and he believed the talking would be done with his fists in the ring. So it wasn't natural for him to come to a press conference and go through some phony ballyhoo as part of the promotion. That just wasn't him at all. He was an out-and-out fighting man, but pleasant to deal with. He wasn't difficult or anything like that, but kind of he didn't really want to play the media game, which probably counted against him a little bit, because in this sport, to get yourself talked about and noticed, you probably do have to do that to get the column inches.
So, John, was he an introvert, or did he have a chip on his shoulder?
I think he was. Well, I think at the time, some people thought this is a guy who's being difficult. I think they thought he did have a chip on his shoulder. But actually, looking back, I don't think that was the case. I think some men are natural communicators, aren't they, and enjoy being in the spotlight. And I don't think Dennis was one of them. I think he was faintly embarrassed at all the ballyhoo. You know, Ian said he didn't like particularly going to press conferences, and I always got the impression that he was not one of those who really craved being a household name, which I guess is just as well, because he never was. But I think he was naturally a fairly reserved and shy human being.
I mean, we're talking, aren't we, on this program about this particular podcast this week, you know, about people who weren't big headline names. Their name wasn't up in lights at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, and they weren't topping the bill at the Albert Hall or the O2 or wherever it is in England. These were people generally skulking around on undercards, probably not being paid great money. Some of them, you know, had those moments of fame, like Steve Robinson, like Dennis Andreese, and some of them probably didn't do themselves too many favors in the publicity department. I remember covering a fighter middleweight called Roy Gums, who was in a terrific fight, by the way, Alexandra Palace one night, only lasted about five rounds with Mark Kaler, but it was a right old tear up. Ahead of that fight, he sat at the press conference and said to us, you know, he was bitter and said, "You've never written about me. You've never paid me any attention. And you'll have to pay me some attention now. I've never got any publicity." So afterwards, I went up to do the radio interview with him, you know, to preview the fight. Said, "Roy, can I just do stuff already?" He goes, "No, I don't talk to reporters." That could explain why you're not getting too much publicity.
Oh, I think we've all had that one person who, you know, might have felt slighted and not got the coverage, and then when you go to do it, they say no. And I've had that before a couple of times.
And if they don't talk to you, Trish, they don't talk to anybody. You've done 200 of those brilliant stories.
I know, and hopefully there's still some pulse left in that. Well, that's it. There's 10 more on the way as well. So, talking of middleweights, John, I mean, Ian said it. Some of the guys made it that we're talking about. Some didn't quite make it to the tippy top. One of the poster boys for that is Harold Bomber Graham, right? And I suppose Law remembers him as this outstanding talent. But has he got the credit he deserved? I mean, certainly, obviously, his story has wound up being a tragic one.
I think he's got the credit he deserves with people like us, you know, because we remember back to him, and he was a sublime talent, particularly in his younger days. I mean, he was never a particularly exciting man to watch because he wasn't a puncher, so you weren't going to enthrall a crowd like, say, Nigel Benn did. But just on the coordination and the silky skills, Harold pretty much had it all. He was a light middleweight first off, won the British title in 1981. At Sheffield City Hall. I mean, that was a pretty small venue, and that shows kind of that even in his hometown, he wasn't a massive ticket seller. Then he went on to get the Commonwealth title, the European title, and he came so close, you know, to winning the world title against Mike McCallum, who was an avoided man when he fought him at Wembley, I think it was. And he'd have won the fight if he hadn't had a point deducted. He spun McCallum in a corner right in front of where Ian and I were covering the fight for BBC Radio, and he tapped him on the back of the head. No more than a tap, I promise you. It wasn't a punch by any means. And for that, he got deducted, I don't know if it was half a point or a point in those days, but he got a deduction because of the foul. And as a result of that, he lost a split decision. And had it not been for that point, Harold would have been a world champion. It was as close as that. And, you know, I mean, and then, of course, we went across in, was it 1990, when he fought Julian Jackson in front of another small crowd in Spain. And that was just heartbreaking because he boxed his ears off. He was trying to finish the fight. He was trying to show that he could be an exciting fighter. He was trying to finish the feared puncher, Julian Jackson. And of course, the rest is history. Jackson was told he'd got one round left. Harold went out there trying, instead of just to box his way through, tried to knock him out. He got chinned, and that was it. Unconscious, loses the fight, never becomes world champion.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at it, and it's an argument we've often had in bars, not even an argument. We've talked about, you know, who is the best British fighter never to win a world title. Harold's right up there in that conversation, isn't he? He was a misnomer, wasn't it? Calling him Bomber. I think that was a nice sense of humour by Brendan Ingle. Because he wasn't that. He was so hard to hit. Do you remember I think they used to take him, didn't he? Brendan used to take Harold to the local jail, and you know, they could win a five or a ten, or I don't know how much it was, if they could land a blow on him. Of course, they didn't have a hope in hell of landing a blow on Harold Graham, because hardly anybody could. It wasn't the most marketable style. I think everybody knew he was kind of brilliant, but he wasn't a marquee name. Do you remember talking to Tony Simpson, and we'll get on to Simo, I'm sure. And somebody said to him, you know, what about a fight with Harold Graham? He said, I'm not fighting that glorified limbo dancer.
and boxing's a business, isn't it, Ian? I remember when Chris Eubank was starting to make a lot of big headlines with fights, which sometimes weren't very good. Let's be brutally honest about it. Some of them were pretty dull. And I remember at a press conference saying to Barry Hearn, you know, an after fight press conference about where does Chris go from here? And I said, well, what about Harold Graham? You know, and he looked at me, and I mean, I knew what he was thinking. He was thinking, I don't need him, and he could stand Chris on his head. But what he actually said was he doesn't bring enough to the table. In other words, he wasn't marketable enough.
Yeah, was the president of the Who Needs Him Club, as Mickey Duff used to say, wasn't he, Harold? You weren't going to make a lot of money, and you're almost certainly going to get beaten. I mean, you mentioned the Julian Jackson fight. Was it used to call him the Hawk, didn't they? Julian Jackson. He was a murderous, lethal puncher, a real lights-out merchant. But Harold just boxed his ears off. and just gave him crazily that one opportunity when they were about to pull him out of the fight, and he just landed that lights out punch, and that was it. Yeah, that was horrible, because he'd done it, and he was surely going to win, and it was the biggest giveaway I think I've ever seen.
And the tragedy, Chris, as you, Tris, as you know only too well, I saw the article that you wrote a year or two back about Harold. You know, despite the fact he went and had another world title fight at what, the age of 38 against Charles Brewer, which he couldn't quite pull off, an unlikely win there. He was never really the same man after that fight. And I think it, you know, I think the fact that so many people said, you know, you're the best fighter never to have won a world title, it kind of got to him a little bit over the years, because he famously said, well, it doesn't buy me anything. It doesn't put food on the table, does it? It's very nice, but it gives me nothing. And I think it was one of the things which contributed to a rather unpleasant downward spiral of depression in his later years.
Yeah, so I remember interviewing Harold. The first time I ever interviewed him was when I was on the staff at Boxing News, so probably about 2007. And I said to him, so Harold, you're the best fighter. And he finished the sentence for me, never to win a world title. And he said it with that great big Harold Bomber smile. But obviously he's heard it to death. And like you said, it doesn't put food on the table. I don't know if that's... because he should have, could have, would have, should have, I know. But in terms of Harold as a person, I mean, I obviously, you know, for Damage, I went and visited him in a psychiatric ward, which was terribly sad. But also I've seen the other side of Harold, where he's been a complete joy to be around. So much fun, so much energy. And I'm guessing that's what you saw more of back in the day, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, I won't go on at length about Carol here. It is sad what happened. I mean, it's a funny word to use about a fighter, really, and the trade that they pursue. But I would call him a sweet man. That's what I always used to think. He was a sweet guy.
Yeah, it's nice.
Very gentle soul, considering he made his living out of boxing.
Ian, you mentioned Tony Simpson. Yeah. Let's cut across to Rawley here. John, what your memories of Tony Simpson? Because you knew him very well, didn't you?
I did extremely well, because I was had my formative years as a journalist in Leicester, and Ian had a little spell up there as well, and would have known him. But you know, yeah. I mean, I knew him. I'd been along to watch him train. I've even been in the ring with Tony Simpson, which mercifully he didn't hit me.
Who won that one?
Well, it was. I think it was Ken Squires' idea. You know, he said, come on, put some gloves on, get in the ring. And Ken Squires, being his left field trainer, was with him all the way through the... But fortunately, I mean, Tony was another one.
We had your points when it was stopped. I thought you were leading.
Tony was another one who was an absolutely lovely man, real sweetheart. And he was another one who was kind of almost embarrassed by the fame which came his way, because he became an absolute cult hero, you know, in Leicester. I can still remember the chants of the fans giving it the Subo, Subo, Subo. And he was immensely popular for a while. And it was just his misfortune, really, that he, in the prime of his career, came up against a man called Hagler, who is perhaps, along with, I don't know, Sugar Ray Robinson, Carlos Monzon, that he's you know, arguably the greatest middleweight of all time. And I think that was really unfortunate for Sibo, because he was a damn good fighter.
He wasn't actually fit for that fight. He probably should have been pulled out of the fight. I mean, fighting Hagler, you need to be 200% fit, don't you? And he wasn't doing any sparring in the last 3 weeks. But his manager at the time, I think, took the view, look, this is a massive payday, let's go do it. So he gave it his best shot and got stopped in 6th round. Well, there was that blizzard I told you about before outside. I think it was 2 foot of snow when I went outside the arena in Worcester, Massachusetts. We had to walk back through it. Nearly didn't make it, by the way. That's another story. But yeah, you're right. But remember, you know, do you remember there was like that cross of the generations thing with Sibo? And it's a way, it's funny the way things work out, isn't it? It doesn't quite work out for him, even that when he won, when he beat Alan Minter. Do you remember? Knocked out Alan Minter.
Yeah, redesigned his face.
And it was supposed to be on peak time TV the next day. So it was going to be, it's going to be massive news and everything. Everyone was going to see him do this to Alan Minter, a former world middleweight champion. Because Minter had the words "death trucks" written on his shorts, BBC wouldn't show the fight. And it was never put on air. So, that great, glorious moment of his never got onto BBC One that night. I mean, it was the daftest decision by the editors and producers. 3 days later, they were showing the British Grand Prix from Silverstone, with Firestone and God knows how many other brands all over the track.
It's funny you mentioned the change in the eras there from Minter to Sibson, because at the other end of Sibson's career, he fought Dennis Andres.
Yeah, that was not, we talked about the fact that Dennis didn't have big fights in terms of public profile and the big atmosphere and the big fight. I guess his fight against Tony Sibson, which turned into a fairly one-sided beating, didn't he? He was just too big for him, and he stopped Tony. In terms of sort of public impact, that was probably the biggest fight of Dennis Andres' career, I would have thought.
And I suppose we can segue here to a man called Mark Kaler, who Tony beat a couple of fights after he fought Hagler, because Kaler, I think, is living his best life over on America's West Coast. But he was best known for, obviously, the fireworks that came before the fight with Errol Christie, Ian.
Oh, yeah. Right, the dust up on the pavement and all that. It was projected him to big back page news, didn't it? So, if you want to sell tickets for a fight, and I think actually that one wasn't one of those that was staged. I think that probably did boil over. He always seemed to me at that age, that tender age, as he was coming through as a fighter and looking to make his name, that he was feisty. There was something about him. You wouldn't want to have an argument with him on the phone, really, Kayla. and he kind of brought that into the interviews you did with him as well. He was always talking about threatening about what he was going to do to the opponent. But he was involved, wasn't he, in that night at Wembley when Bruno got beaten for the first time by Bonecrusher Smith. And Mark, they were giving him his pretty significant test too with Buster Drayton, and that went wrong as well. So Terry Lawless had that awful night where he threatened to retire and quit boxing. He did, and 48 hours later, he changed his mind. But yeah, it never quite happened for Mark Kaler.
It was a pretty awful atmosphere in the crowd, wasn't it, when Kaler fought Sibson, because it was the West Ham boys, the East London lads who followed Kaler in against the Leicester faithful, and who were just fanatical in support of Sibson. I remember that night up in the bleachers. Was that one at Wembley, Ian?
Wasn't it? Like football hooligan atmosphere.
It was awful.
Yeah.
Just before we leave Sibbo, I just wanted to just give a little quote that I remember Marvin Hagler coming away with, because he'd obviously turned in a tremendous performance, Hagler. But before the fight happened, he said, "British people have led him on. They've led him to his destruction. But if Sibson wins, he'll go home a national hero. If I win, I'll just go home."
Do you remember Hagler always used to call him Simpson as well? He used to get his name, Tony Simpson.
probably deliberately, you suspect.
That's great stuff. I'll say a word here. Unfortunately, very sadly, it was the funeral of Buster Drayton yesterday. So may he rest in peace. Guy who was in my book, The Road to Nowhere, who was always very, very nice and kind to me.
Mills Lane as well, Tris. Mills Lane, the referee's died, hasn't he?
Well, there's probably a podcast there on Mills Lane fights, which we can do down the road, which would be a nice tribute for Mills.
I think we ought to do that, because when we look back at all the refs we've seen over the years, there's a lot of unsung heroes there, and I think there's a very, very live argument that certainly, so far as Las Vegas, Reno, obviously, which is where he comes from, but so far as American fights, big American fights of that era are concerned, I think there's a very real argument that Mills Lane was the best of the lot.
Didn't he used to do a TV program where he was like a judge? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was after he finished as a referee. They gave him a prime time show where he was a judge, you know, calling out cases, and actually, you know, made a very, very popular TV series. But sadly, he had a stroke in 2002, and the last 20 years of his life, he was very much in a kind of incapacitated, and it was sad, really, that somebody who had such a sharp mind should have been left in that way.
He did the bite of the century, Tyson Holyfield, didn't he?
He did, yeah. And I think Fan Man, I think he did a lot of those huge, weird. I think he might have done the Oliver McCall breakdown as well. I think he did a lot of those.
I'm pretty sure he did Holmes versus Cooney, and that was the first time he used the "Let's get it on" line.
Yep. Yeah.
Which, of course, he's remembered for to this day.
Yeah, those Americans used to have those little catchphrases, didn't they? You know, Cortez, I'm firm, but I'm fair. You know, all that stuff is all part of the show, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think they've gone downhill since Mills, though. I think that's everyone's desperate to be the next Mills Lane, the same way everyone's desperate to be the next Michael Buffer. But they are one-offs. It's a bit of a sad move here, but obviously we talked about Mills Lane struggling later in life and ultimately passing away. Kirkland Lang didn't have a very happy end to his life. And if you haven't seen it, go onto YouTube and look up Kirkland Lang and Steve Bunce, and you can find this wonderful, hugely interesting video of Buncey trying to find Kirkland Lang on the streets of Nottingham, I think. And he does actually find Kirkland, but it's a very, very sad video. Reminds me a lot of the Road to Nowhere days, me traveling around America trying to find these lost heroes. But you would have known him again, Ian, back when Kirkland Lang was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Yeah, but he was another one, really, who never attracted huge dollops of publicity. There were other bigger name fighters around, so... You know, he fought Roberto Duran, didn't he, famously, and beat Roberto Duran. And after that, Duran, you know, people said at the time, well, Duran was like a, you know, bloated, hadn't trained properly for the fight. But after that, Duran came back and beat Davey Moore, didn't he, and had another big phase of his career. So,
what did Kirkland Lang do? Lang went missing.
One. They called him the gifted one. He was crazily gifted. He was lovely to watch on a going day. He was a beautiful boxer to watch. I so enjoyed watching him. But, you know, he threw it away twice against Colin Jones. And I'll always remember in one of those fights, the second one, I mean, Terry Lawless knew what he was like. His mind would go off and wander halfway through the fight. And I remember Terry Lawless sending him out for about the seventh round and screaming at him. We could all hear it at ringside. Screamed at him, "Concentrate, Kirk! Concentrate!" He's shouting at him. But, you know, there was a carbon copy ending twice against Colin Jones in, I think it was the ninth round, wasn't it, as memory serves?
Twice. And Mickey Duff, who was his manager, I remember he said to me, that he could have been the best fighter in the world. But he said, what do you do? What could you do? What could I do when I couldn't get in touch with him? I didn't know where he was. He went missing for a year after that, or more than a year after that Duran fight, you know, drinking, smoking weed, screwing around, whatever, and just generally partying. And they reckoned that in the time he was out of the ring, where Mickey Duff would have loved to have capitalized, Roberto Duran went and had four fights in that time and earned $6 million. You know, that's the difference. Oh, by the way, Don King, who was involved in that fight against Duran as on the promotional side, he reckoned that he'd been done over by Mickey Duff, and they reckoned it was about 4 years before he'd speak to Mickey again after that.
Yeah, he was supposed to bring out some kind of dummy who was going to lose easily to a kind of fat Duran, and he brought out Kirkland Lang. I mean, that reminds me a little bit of you know, when Danny Williams was wheeled on to fight Mike Tyson. You know, they thought, oh, it's a soft, easy fight for Mike because that's the only ones he's going to win now. And I remember Jay Larkin, who was the boss of Showtime when he was alive, sadly no longer with us. But and him saying to me, Mike is going to win, isn't he? There's no problem, is there, with this guy of yours? I said, He could really fight if he gets his mind around it. He doesn't often, but he does have a big level of ability. Yeah. Does he? He said, does he? And he looked really worried. Of course, he only won.
That's great.
Kirkland Trez was one of those guys who was until you know the later years when he began to look a little bit ravaged by the excesses in which he indulged. You know, he was one of those who, right into his mid to late 30s, he was an amazing physical specimen. I mean, he really was a great athlete just to look at from an aesthetic point of view. And I remember watching him and doing a fight in 1990 when he fought a guy who probably nobody listening to this would even remember, but he fought a guy called Antoine Fernandez and he beat him. I think it was at the Royal Albert Hall and he won the European title. He was about 36 or 37 years old. And you watched him on that night. I don't know if you remember it, Ian, but you watch him on that night and you were thinking, oh my God, you know, what could this guy have been if only he'd buckled down? And you know, his old trainer, Joe Ryan, he said, I think after that one, he said, people have never seen the real Kirkland Lang. You've only seen 1/20th of what this guy can do.
He was the ultimate British wasted talent. I think he'd be number one on that list because he could never really concentrate on being that guy. And if he lived the life, but maybe if he'd lived the life, maybe he wouldn't have been that performer that he was in the ring. I don't know. But, you know, there weren't many fighters you thought, I'm really looking forward to going and seeing him tonight. And Kirkland Lang was one of those.
That's great because I think, you know, when you cover sport as thoroughly and as much as you guys have, it's those guys that you would pay the ticket money for, right? They're the ones that stand out, you know, the guys that even if you weren't working, you wouldn't resent having to put your hand in your pocket to go and watch these magicians, would you? No, it's quite
James Toney was another one like that. You know, he at his best, he just had that such a liquid movement in the ring.
And you mentioned Kurt Lang, obviously. Well, we mentioned Colin Jones in there. Obviously, they're sort of intertwined in a little bit. And I suppose Colin Jones is the same. He retired after 26 wins, just 3 losses and a draw. And obviously, he had those 2 razor close fights with Milton McCrory. Did either of you cover either of the McCrory fights?
I didn't remember them, but I remember watching them, and I remember how close he came to getting right to the top. And you know, he's another bloke who's sort of got folk hero status in Wales, and he runs the Welsh amateur setup nowadays. And he was there at the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham this summer, and still, you know, just totally self-effacing. If you asked him about his fighters, he wanted to make it all about them. Never want to give it the big I am, and that was Colin.
He was a humble guy. He used to be a grave digger. Do you remember the grave? They always wrote the same thing in the tabloid press. Colin Jones, the ex grave digger from Gorsinan. He probably got fed up with reading that, but he was a hard man. He was a puncher. You know, he found the punch to stop Kirkland Lang twice. I was at both of his fights with Milton McCrory. One of them was in Reno, Nevada. And they gave him the draw, but I remember Eddie Thomas saying to him at the end of the fight, and I overheard Eddie say to him, not quite enough, son, not quite enough. And I think he probably did just lose it. And then he had that second fight in Vegas again for the world title, the rematch, and it was about 120 degrees. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Las Vegas, outdoors. You can imagine what that was like. So he lost that. And then he had the fight with Don Curry, didn't he? When around the time Don Curry was being regarded as the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world, put in a terrific effort, I thought, but got beaten at Birmingham. And I remember seeing him afterwards. I was leaving the arena. I'd filed a report, and he was in tears. He was leaning against a wall, and he had his head in his hand, and he was gently sobbing. And I remember putting my arm around him and said, look, you know, Colin, for what it's worth, and it isn't worth much, I said, you know, you did yourself proud in there. You couldn't have done more. And he just said, thanks, and carried on and sort of drifted off. But that was sad to see.
It's those anecdotes that make this podcast what it is. You know, it's that little peek behind the curtain, you know. Sorry, John.
I was just going to say another one. You know, I mean, the older guys have, even older than Ian, have told me about the days of Dave Charnley, and they talk about sort of great fighters who never quite got there, and Dave Charnley was one of those, wasn't he? He fought Joe Brown twice in world title fights. One of them was reputedly an absolutely huge injustice. The papers, everybody at ringside just thought he'd been totally done. And it was because his manager at the time didn't get on with the referee, a bloke called Tommy Little. And Tommy Little was the bloke who scored the fight. It was just one man in those days. And he got absolutely sawn off. You know, he should have been a world champion, Charnley. Two shots, first time in 1959, then again in 1961. And on both times, he came up short, which is, a great shame. He went on to become a very successful businessman, made himself so much money that the offices for his company were on Regent Street. So that tells you how well he did away from boxing. But actually, as a fighter, you know, the old Dartford Destroyer, as they called him, he probably should have been a world champion.
Yeah, I think you have to confirm your story there. Of course, you know, not even I was around then, as you so succinctly said, John. I'm beginning to feel like I'm the oldest fighter reporter around left. but no, I don't remember that. I do remember reading all about it. And of course, when I first started covering the sport, you know, people like Colin Hart and all that, and Sydney Hulls from the Express and all the, I mean, they did cover him. Old Alan Hobie, who used to write, remember him? He used to write press, you know, he'd seen everything. And he said exactly what you just said, that he was robbed in one of the fights for certain. He was, I think you called him Old Bones, didn't they? Joe Brown.
Yep.
I do remember as a kid listening to one of those fights on the radio. I used to love listening to the commentaries on the fights on the radio. And of course, both John and I were lucky enough to follow that famous line of commentators who did that job.
Yeah, so you know, Old Bones actually, at the time, if they'd had pound for pound list, Brown would have been on them for sure. Sorry, John.
He did actually get a win. They brought him over again in 1963, but by then Joe was, you know, on his way to being washed up, and Charnley actually won the third fight. Yeah, I shouldn't really share too much about how the world can be manipulated, but you can actually go on Wikipedia and make little additions. And I have to confess that, you know, Ian, we jokingly refer to him as sort of, we used to call him the old guy, and I put on Wikipedia, Ian Dark, born in 1924, affectionately known to his mates and colleagues as the old guy. It was a while before Ian caught up with that.
The old guy. Yeah. Well, I was old when I was about 27 then.
That's what happens when you got to go and interview Mike Tyson. Put years on you.
That's why I'm not getting any more contracts given to me. People think I'm even older than I am. John thinks I'm flying Spitfires in the Second World War, I think, you know.
Oh dear. We've talked about some fighters who didn't win a world title. I think one of the guys on the list that we should talk about didn't just not get to win a world title. He didn't even fight for one. Jamie Moore, who's obviously now one of the top trainers in the country. And Jamie, I mean, obviously, when you talk about the pinnacle of his career, it would have been taking out his old friend Matt Macklin. Darkie, that was one of yours, wasn't it?
Yeah, I remember covering that fight. Jamie Moore, yeah, I mean, he had a good level of ability, didn't he? Good fight between those two, wasn't it, that night? I think he pulled out something special, but it, you know, just probably wasn't quite enough. I mean, I've got to be honest, my memories of that fight aren't as clear as they probably should be. Maybe I am older than I thought.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the great British fights. I mean, people do put it alongside Arthur Gomez and those sort of ones. But I seem to remember, John, and you might be able to flesh this out for me, but I think Jamie beat Michele Piccirillo, the Italian. But it was just for some reason he just couldn't get this. He was with Frank Maloney, and it just didn't happen for him, where he got the opportunity to fight for a world title. And there aren't many people who were better than Jamie, certainly in the current age of so many world titles, where you get to that level and you don't even get a shot.
Well, I think now he probably would have been a world champion, wouldn't he? Or he'd certainly have had a shot. You know, you can think about others like Pat Barrett, like Gary Jacobs, the Scottish lad. You know, they were kind of unfortunate. A lot of it's about timing. If you're somebody as Gary was, who comes up in the same era as Pernell Whitaker, you know, you're finding it fairly tough to become a world champion. Likewise, Pat Barrett, you know, I mean, I think in the modern era, he'd have been a world champion. And I think everybody who was around and knew him and saw him knows how talented and hard Pat was. But he never quite got over the line. And sometimes it's the nature of boxing. You know, it's not just sport, is it? A lot of it is down to sort of politics and being in the right place at the right time, knowing the right person. And the list of people who prosper despite the system, you know, people like Marvin Hagler, like Bernard Hopkins, they're fairly few and far between.
Yeah. I mean, Michael Brody's another name I'd throw in there. Do you remember he got robbed in a fight against Willie Horeen in Manchester? I was furious about that. Just occasionally covering boxing, I'd throw my pen down in exasperation at the scoring. And I definitely did that night. I remember one of the judges was Bob Logist of Belgium. And right after they'd announced this decision, which stank to me, absolutely stank. And there was a bomb scare. And we all had to go outside. And I found myself standing next to Bob Logist. And I couldn't resist saying it. I said, "Where did you put that blindfold that you were watching that fight with?" I said, "How on earth could you have come?" And he was very sheepish as well, I remember, in the conversation. But, yeah, you know, Michael won that fight for me. And he never got it.
Well, do you remember as well, there was heartbreak for Brody, wasn't there? Because then he went life and death with Injin Chi, who was an absolute warrior. And really, yeah. I think that drained Brody's reserves, because I think they got Chi over and he bashed him up in the rematch, which was a real sad, because he should have beaten Horeen and made his first defense against Chi for big money. And the way it worked out, again, we're talking about someone now who lost out due to boxing politics and has had to, a less than triumphant life after boxing. It's terribly sad when you see these guys on the short end or treated, just got the wrong end of the stick badly.
Michael, you remember Michael? I remember him telling me, and it kind of brought it really home to me where he was from and what his story was. He said he was fighting. One of his first aims was to make enough money to buy a gravestone for his mother.
Pretty poignant stuff, that, isn't it? He wasn't a ticket seller, Michael, really, was he? He was managed by Jack Trickett, the old Stockport hotelier, who was part of the Quality Street gang up in Manchester, who's still alive to this day. He's into his 90s now, Jack. But he was Michael was his pride and joy. That fight against Injin Chi, the first one, which was in 2003 at the MEN. I mean, that was a wonderful fight. But yeah, he was never the same again after that. The rematch, he took him out in 7 rounds, I think. And then he had one final go at the WBO title, by which time Michael sadly was a bit of a shell. And Scott Harrison was just too much for him and just wiped him out in 3 or 4 rounds.
Yeah, Scott was a beast then.
I'll throw in for discussion Errol Christie, who everybody thought was going to be a sensation the way he was as an amateur.
Well, we talked a little bit earlier about the Kronk gym, didn't we? And I think he was somebody, you know, some people thrive in that atmosphere. I think Errol was pretty much destroyed by it.
Yeah, I remember Errol from my boxing news days, and went to speak to him, and he was doing a motivational speech for underprivileged kids in London, and he was terrific. And the next thing you knew, he had cancer and the clock was ticking. It was terribly, terribly sad. Another guy, really, who after boxing, life just was so unkind. But sorry, Ian, I cut you off there.
No, not at all. I mean, what you're saying there, Tris, and we're having this discussion, and it's a little bit depressing that so many of the stories of these fighters haven't gone the right way. I always wished that these guys were so brave and doing what they did basically for our entertainment, that all you ever wish for them was that they would leave the business healthy and hopefully wealthy as well, because they nearly all deserved it. Not just the guys who were the headliners and the star names, the guys that filled in on undercards, sometimes at very short notice, sometimes at dangerously short notice. If you're talking about the real journeyman who came from, you know, places like the Knobby Knobs gym up in Birmingham, you know, they'd be doing painting and decorating in the afternoon and the phone would go at 3 o'clock and they'd say, you know, can you get down to the York or Bethnal Green? You know, we've got a spot on the undercards. There's been a pull out, and, you know, they get in the car and go down and fight. So
Greaves, the Centurion Johnny Greaves, he's been watching the fights on a Saturday night, had a chippy tea and a bottle of Sol or a Budweiser, and got the phone to cut across the O2 to cut across London to the O2, which is incredible stuff. And I think it's interesting, though, because, John, you've mentioned this a couple of times with some of these guys and their followings. And we've now got this Nathan Heaney in Stoke, and Ian, you'll remember Scott Dann in Plymouth, where we've had these hotspots, and Baby Joe Messi, the heavyweight, who was called the third franchise in Buffalo because he had such a big local following. But John, where we've talked about Leicester, let's go back there, because even though he won a world title, Chris Pyatt is not a household name, and he got to the top of the mountain in that respect.
He did. Chris fought over 50 times. He was a Commonwealth gold medalist in Brisbane in 1982. He'd fought for the world title in 1990 when he came up against a very good guy who we'd all remember, a light middleweight who was world champion, John David Jackson, who went on to become a very fine boxing trainer. He finally got to the top of the pile by beating a man called Sumbu Kalembe in 1993, who was a good fighter, African fighter. And then he lost the title the following year to Steve Collins, which, of course, gave Collins the world title, which enabled him to go on to the super fights against Chris Eubank and against Nigel Benn. But Chris Pyatt was never, you know, I mean, he, likeable though he was, he was no orator and he was no interviewee. He was no great man for the headline writers. And as a result of that, he didn't even have a particularly big following in his own city, never mind the rest of the country.
Yeah, that was right. He was another one that was basically not really covered, except a few paragraphs here and there. Quite weird, wasn't it, the way that happened?
Well, he won the world title at the old Granby Halls in Leicester, which was quite a small arena. I know it had big fights if you go back into the 1930s, but in modern terms, it wasn't the sort of place where a headline fight was being put on.
But I went and saw the Rolling Stones there, John. Granby Hall, Leicester.
Yeah, really?
They were good. I got in free. Yeah. I was on the late shift on Radio Leicester and there was nothing happening. And I thought, I'll go down and see that Stones concert. And I blacked my way in and saw the Rolling Stones. I was supposed to be doing the 9 o'clock news desk, I think, or something, but I got back just in time to do it.
How did you get in? Did you walk in and say, do you know who I am?
Yeah, no, I flashed a BBC card and said I was doing a review and lied that I had an interview lined up. And they just waved me through. It was, yeah.
Did you tell them all how you remember when the place used to be just fields?
The Granby Halls, yeah, no, I remember it well. There was the De Montfort Hall in Leicester as well, wasn't there? All those places. You mentioned Johnny Greaves there. Yes. My son Adam did a great documentary about him. I don't know if any of you ever caught that.
Yeah, definitely. On BT Sport.
Yeah. So if you haven't seen that, and I'd recommend anyone to go back and look at that. It's almost the ultimate profile of the journeyman fighter and Johnny's sort of family situation and relationships within the family all came out there, and really what he was trying to prove to himself every time he got in a boxing ring. It was a multi-layered. It was complex and revealing.
Those guys are so important for the whole fabric of boxing as we know it, aren't they? You know, we mentioned Norman Nobby Nobbs, who was a Birmingham doorman who used to work for a Birmingham nightclub. Well, I almost said gangster, but he was certainly notorious. A man called Eddie Futrells, and Nobby was one of his doormen, and he had this little stable of sort of guaranteed losers who'd fight anywhere around the country. But through to this day, you know, I mean, Errol Johnson's got people on his books, Carl Greaves, Chris Sanigar. You know, these are people who are below the top level of promoters and managers, but without them, boxing wouldn't work.
Chris Sanigar, now, crikey, what a fighter he was. When he was fighting, he was a wild man, wasn't he, in the ring? It was just, it was like lighting a firework. Win or lose, it was usually some spectacular, I'd call it more like a blaze going on in the ring.
I remember going for a pint with Harry Mullen in one of those pubs around the back of Broadcasting House. And there was myself and Bob Mee, you know, just putting the world to rights about this, that, and the other that's going on in boxing at the moment. And Chris Sanigar walked in, and I'd not met him before. And I thought, what a nice man. And he sort of tootled off at the end of it. And Harry said to me with that mischievous twinkle in his eye and the old Irish accent, you know, he said, yeah, he's a nice man. He said, but you wouldn't want to have an argument with him.
Yeah. Well, there was a piece in Boxing News back in the day, probably around that time, definitely in Harry's time, where there was something about someone nearly running him over on their way to the pub, and someone getting out of the car to give Chris a piece of their mind, and they wound up with a lot more than that. Let's leave it at that. And there's that great line at the start of obviously my Boxing Life Stories podcast where Chris is fighting a kid out in Africa. And he goes back to his corner and he's been bitten. And he says to the guy in this corner, he says, I've been bitten. And the man in his corner says, well, bite him back. Which is, I mean, I don't know how far that goes in terms of great corner work, but I don't know.
Yeah, get disqualified quick.
What do you do with that? What do you do? I don't know. But yeah, great, great guy, great story. In terms of Chris Pyatt, though, it's a curious one. He still doesn't do much media, much press now. But it's a shame when these guys have a lot to be proud of. And they're still, you know, maybe they're not the greatest orators, but they do deserve to be remembered for sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're standing here talking about him now. So I guess he's not completely forgotten, and we remember that he was a damn good boxer, Chris Pyatt. He was a good fighter, you know. And you're right; he doesn't get the credit he deserves one little bit. But you know, you can go right up into the modern era, I think, and there are people who are in that boat. You know, I mean, I think Jack Catterall was absolutely robbed that fight against Josh Taylor. I was right in the Catterall camp on that one. I think he got a stinking decision, and I think he should have been the world champion. You know, a year on, because that's what it is now, near as damn it, we're still waiting for a rematch, which will happen in the new year at some point, we're told. Now, if Josh Taylor wins that, will anybody really remember in 20 or 30 years' time the night when Jack Catterall should have been a world champion?
No, I mean, but there are 100 stories like that. Well, more than 100, aren't there, if you want to go back, of very questionable decisions. And of course, it's a game of snakes and ladders, as Mickey Duff always used to say, and the snakes can be pretty long.
Look at Kid Galahad. Came with a wafer thin defeat against Josh Warrington, and there were plenty of people there that night who thought that Barry had won that fight. He goes on from there and he loses to Martinez, loses to Maxie Hughes, and now where is he? You know, to come back to where he almost was from where he now is well nigh impossible. And, you know, again, in 20 or 30 years, who's going to remember him?
Yeah. It's tough, isn't it? It's tough. I mean, yes, sorry.
You mentioned Bob Meade. I mean, we had a lot of good times with Bob, and certainly I've got to say, as you know, Sky Sports commentator, and Bob used to do all the research notes, you know, and without him, he made us look good, but he could also be very funny. I remember there was a guy that Joe Calzaghe fought called, who called himself Kid Fire McIntyre. He was absolutely hopeless, and Bob wrote in notes, more like Ceasefire McIntyre. You'll find, which is, and he, do you remember that other guy, John, Tocker Pudwill?
He was another terrifying character.
He was terrible.
Was he the one who was on the undercard of Mike Tyson against Brian Nielsen over in Copenhagen?
That was the McIntyre one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Joe got one or two, didn't he?
So, you mentioned Bob Mee there. I mean, just in closing, I think we'll wrap this up. This has been a great trip, actually. I didn't know what to expect from this episode, but it's delivered in spades again.
It's been fun.
Yeah, but we talked about unsung heroes at the start, and I suppose, like Bob Mee, plenty of them have been behind the scenes, and I suppose none more so than Mike Goodall, who is obviously of ringcraft fame, who has done emceeing. He's built the rings, transported them here, there, everywhere, and it's just been part of the scene for, well, probably since the mid-80s, I guess. And I suppose you both have spent a lot of time in Mike's company. Let's start with you, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, he deserves to win a knighthood, doesn't he, Mike Goodall? He, as you said, he's done it all. He knows it all. He's a really shrewd judge. We had a lot of great laughs with him. He's there putting up the ring. God knows what time he got home every time. He'd have to unpack it all. He must have got home at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Probably set off somewhere else for a Ron Gray promotion in Wolverhampton or something the next night. So, I liked Mike. I mean, there are a lot of characters, aren't there, around the side of boxing who the public don't know about, without whom it wouldn't work.
Well, they call Mike the hardest working man in boxing, don't they? And I think there's a very persuasive argument that that's the case. And I tell you what, as well, Ian, you must have been for a night out with him. What good fun he is as well. When he gets, you get into one of those Irish bars over the road from the Europa, get in Robinson's or a bit of live Irish music, and he's there necking a few pints of Guinness, worked his socks off all day, and he can party with the best of them. He's a lovely guy to be around, and you know, I feel very pleased to say that I know Mike Goodall, and I you know, treasure his company when I have it.
Yeah, good stuff. All right then, gents. Well, let's put a bow on this one for today. But it's been a lot of fun reconnecting with you both after our short break. We will be back soon. Guys, if you are enjoying this podcast, please leave us a rating and give us a review on iTunes. We will be taking questions soon for future episodes. So if you have any questions of a nostalgic manner for the guys, then please send them over via Twitter to any of us, to myself, John, or Ian. But guys, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much, and we'll be back next week.
I'm surprised that John can remember all this stuff, by the way, because he's only 24.
as opposed to being born in 1924. All right, guys. Okay, take care, gents.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.